This is Audible.
Hawaii by James A. Michener. Introduction by Steve Barry. Read for you by Larry A. McKeever. With an introduction read by Fred Sanders.
This halting of the lava was the worst single blow Abner Hale experienced in Lahaina. For coming so quickly after the defection of Keoki and his sister, it was interpreted as confirming their marriage. While Noelani's demonstrated ability to influence the ancient gods convinced Hawaiians that they still survived, and many began drifting away from the Christian church. But what hurt Abner most was the hilarity with which Americans greeted the miracle. One profane captain kept shouting, "From here on, count me a firm believer in Madame Pele." Another promised, "Now, if Noelani will only take care of the storms, I'll join her church, too." Abner, suffering at each defection from his church and wincing at the American jibes, became obsessed with the lava incident and went about arguing with anyone who would listen. The burning rock came so far and stopped. What's so miraculous about that? "Ah, but who stopped it?" his tormentors would parry. "A woman stands before a nose of lava as it's about to die down, and that's a miracle?" he snorted contemptuously. "Ah, but what if she hadn't been there?" the logicians queried. After some weeks, Abner went at last, and grudgingly, to consult with John Whipple, and the young scientist reassured him. When the internal pressures of a volcano become powerful enough, they erupt into violence. Depending solely upon the interior forces within the earth and nothing more, lava is spewed forth and rolls down mountainsides. If there's enough lava, it's got to reach the ocean. If there isn't, it stops somewhere en route. "Are these things known?" Abner asked. "By anyone with a grain of intelligence," Whipple replied. "Look at Lanai. Anyone can see it was a volcano once. Look at our own Maui. At one time, it had to be two separate volcanoes, gradually coalescing along that line. I would guess that at some time, all the separate islands we see from this pier were one great island." "How could that have been?" Abner queried. "Either the islands sank or the sea rose. Either explanation would do." The grandeur of this concept was too difficult for Abner to accept, and he retreated to certainty. "We know that the world was created 4,004 years before the birth of Christ, and there is no record of islands having risen or fallen." The idea was repugnant to him. Whipple was going to ask about the flood, but he changed the subject and casually remarked, "Abner, why did you put yourself in such a bad light at the marriage of Keoki and Noelani? You surrendered a lot of influence that week." "It was an abomination, unnatural, unclean," Abner stormed. "I've been thinking about it a great deal," Whipple reflected. "What's so dreadful about it? Now really, don't quote me incidents from the Bible. Just tell me." "It's abhorrent and unnatural," Abner stormed, still hurting from the actions of his two preferred Hawaiians. "What's really so abhorrent about it?" Whipple pressed. "Every civilized society," Abner began, but his companion grew impatient and snapped, "Damn it, Abner, every time you start an answer that way, I know it's going to be irrelevant. Two of the most completely civilized societies we've ever had were the Egyptians and the Incas. Now, no Egyptian king was ever allowed to marry anybody but his sister, and if I can believe what I've heard, the same was true of the Incas. They prospered. As a matter of fact," Whipple continued, "it's not a bad system scientifically. That is, if you're willing to kill off ruthlessly any children with marked defects. And apparently the Egyptians, the Incas, and the Hawaiians were willing to do so. Have you ever seen a handsomer group of people than the Ali'i?" Abner felt that he was going to be sick, but before he could react to Whipple's astonishing reflections, the doctor said, "Noelani has asked me to attend her at the birth of the baby." "Of course you rebuked her," Abner said with assurance. "Oh, no. A doctor could practice an entire lifetime and not meet such an opportunity," Whipple explained. You would be partner to such a crime? Abner asked, stunned by the prospect. Naturally, Whipple said. And the two men walked back from the pier in silence. But when Abner reached home and sent the children out into the walled yard, he confided in whispers to his wife the nauseating news that John Whipple was preparing to attend Noelani. But to his surprise, Jerusha replied, Of course. The girl deserves all consideration. This must be doubly frightening for her. But John Whipple, a consecrated Christian. The important thing is that he's a doctor. Do you suppose I ever rested easily, knowing that a totally untrained man would be my attendant when the children were born? Were you so afraid? Abner asked in surprise. I began by being, Jerusha said. But my love for you made it possible to control my fears. Even so, I'm glad that Brother John is going to tend the girl. Abner started to rant, but Jerusha had, in these months of his defeat, heard enough, and now she said firmly, My dearest husband, I am afraid you are making a fool of yourself. What do you mean? He gasped, rising and walking with agitation to the door. You are fighting the Kahunas, and Kelolo, and Keoki, and Noelani, and even Dr. Whipple. In church you speak without benevolence. You act as if you hated Lahaina and all that was in it. You've even withdrawn from your children so that Micah told me, Father hasn't taught me Hebrew for 2 months. I have been sorely tried, Abner confessed. I appreciate the shocks you've suffered, Jerusha said tenderly, pulling her tense little husband into one of the wailing chairs. But if, as I think, we are here engaged in a tremendous battle between the old gods and the new. She saw that this phraseology hurt Abner, so she quickly modified it. What I mean is, between heathenish ways and the way of the Lord, then we ought to fight with our subtlest resources. When the old seems about to reconquer the islands, we ought to combat it with... I've warned them all, Abner shouted, rising from his chair and striding about the earthen floor. I told Kelolo. What I meant was, Jerusha said gently, rising to be with her agitated husband, that in these crucial times you ought to be calmer than usual, quieter, and more forceful. You've told me how you pointed at the evil three, Keoki, Noelani, and Kelolo, and told them in turn, God will destroy you. But you haven't told me or shown me how, with Christ's gentle love, you have tried to guide the people in these confusing times. I've watched you become increasingly bitter, and Abner, it must stop. It is you who are destroying the good you have accomplished. I feel as if I had achieved nothing, he said, from the depths of his spiritual humiliation. Jerusha caught her husband's passing hand and imprisoned him, turning his pinched face to hers. My dearest husband, she said formally, if I were to recount your accomplishments in Lahaina, it would take the rest of my life. Look at that little girl in the sunlight. If you had not been here, she would have been sacrificed. When I see her, Abner said with racking pain in his heart, I can see only little Iliki, that sweetest of all children, being passed from one whaling ship to another. The words were so unexpected, for Abner had not spoken of Iliki for some time, that Jerusha, recalling her dearest pupil, felt bitter tears welling into her eyes. But she fought them back and said, If in losing Iliki we impressed the islanders, and Abner, they were impressed. She stopped and blew her nose, concluding her remarks with a firm command. My dearest counselor, you are to smile. You are to preach about great and lofty subjects. You are to win these people to the Lord with bonds of charity so profound that the islands will be God's forever. You must preach love. With this master theme drummed into his ears by Jerusha week after week, Abner Hale launched into the series of sermons which completed the winning of Lahaina. For as he spoke of the good life and the effect of God's love upon mankind, he found that, whereas he had believed that the islanders had turned away from the Lord, following the example of Kelolo and his children, exactly the contrary was the case. For the common people sensed that in Kelolo's reversion to the old ways there was no real hope for them. And Abner's thoughtful, quiet words of consolation found their way into many hearts that had rejected his earlier ranting. He preached a doctrine which was new to him. The Holy Word of God, as interpreted by Jerusha Bromley, modified by the mysteries encountered in an alien land. He continued to hammer forcefully at man's inescapable sin, but his major emphasis was now upon the consoling intercession of Jesus Christ. And what held his listeners doubly was his return to the tactic he had used as a very young man when preaching to the whalers on the Falklands. He addressed himself exactly to those problems which were perplexing his congregation, so that when he spoke of Christ's compassion, he said bluntly, "Jesus Christ will understand the confusions faced by his beloved son Keoki Kanakoa, and Jesus will find it possible to love his erring servant, even as you and I should love him." These words, when they reached Keoki and the grass palace, shattered him and drove him to the seashore, where he walked for hours, pondering the nature of Christ, as he recalled him from the early, secure days in the mission school at Cornwall, in distant Connecticut. Then, Jesus was perceptible reality, and the eroding loss of this concept agonized Keoki. When it was known that Noelani was approaching her time of delivery and that her child must be born before the next Sabbath, Abner took public cognizance of this fact, and instead of ranting against the circumstances in which the child had been conceived, he spoke for more than an hour and a half on the particular love Christ has for little children. And he recalled his own emotions at the birth of his two sons and two daughters, of his love for the child Iliki, who was now lost. For as he receded from the facts of Iliki's disappearance, she became younger and younger in his memory. And of the joy that all Lahaina must feel that their beloved Ali'inui was about to have a child. Since Hawaiians love nothing more than children, with whom they were gentle and understanding, the 2,000 worshippers sniffled quietly during the last 15 minutes of the sermon, so that, without quite knowing how he had accomplished the strategy, Abner found that his words of compassion had quite won Lahaina away from Kelolo and his kahunas, whereas his earlier ranting had been driving the Hawaiians back to the old gods. It was with confusion, therefore, that Lahaina awaited the birth of its next Ali'inui. As loyal Hawaiians, they rejoiced that their noble line was to be continued. As Christians, they knew that an evil thing had been done by Kelolo and his children. Noelani bore twins, and Dr. Whipple, after he left the grass palace, reported to his waiting wife, "We must prepare ourselves for an ugly moment, Amanda. The boy was a handsome child, but the girl was deformed. I suppose they will abandon her before morning." And when it was whispered through the town that Keoki Kanakoa, with his own hands, had taken his malformed daughter and had placed her at the edge of the tide for the shark god Mano, a wave of revulsion swept through the town. On Sunday, the Lahaina church was jammed with nearly 3,000 people, as in the old days. But on the way to service, Jerusha said quietly to her husband, "Remember, my beloved husband, God has spoken on this subject. You are not required to." And on the instant, Abner threw away the text on which he was prepared to thunder, Luke 23, verse 34, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," and spoke instead from those majestic words of Ecclesiastes, which had been much in his mind of late. "One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever." The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come. He spoke of the permanence of Maui, of how the whales came back each year to play in the roads, and of how the sunset moved majestically through the months from the volcano of Lanai to the tip of Molokai. He referred to the whistling wind that could blow down churches, and of the dead past when Kamehameha himself had trod these roads in mighty conquest. "The earth abideth forever," he cried in soft Hawaiian. And Jerusha, listening to the inspired flow of images, knew that the hatred he had recently held for Lahaina was now discharged. For he passed on from the physical world that endures to the human society which occupies the world. "With all its imperfections, it endures," Abner confessed. But promptly, he went on to his permanent vision of Geneva as it had been ruled by Calvin and Beza, and by suggesting many unspoken comparisons, he led his huge congregation to the truth he himself was seeking. Some forms of human behavior are better than others. And at this point, he returned to an idea which had, through the years, become a passion with him, that a society is good when it protects children. "Jesus Christ loves even children who are not perfect," he preached. And on this awful contrast, he concluded. "What did he say about the baby?" Keoki asked nervously, fingering his mylai leaves in the old grass palace as his spies reported to him. "Nothing," the man replied. "Did he rave about our sin?" the agitated young man pressed. "No, he spoke of how beautiful Maui is." There was a pause, and the man explained. "He did not speak either of you or of Noelani, but at one point I thought he intended saying that if you ever want to return to the church, he will forgive you." The effect of these words upon Keoki was startling, for he began to tremble as if someone were shaking him. And after a while he retired with his confusions to a corner of his room, placing himself formally upon a pile of tapa as if he were already dead, and saying, "Go away." As his friends departed, they whispered among themselves, "Do you think he has decided to die?" The question was seriously discussed, for the Hawaiians knew that Keoki was tormented by doubts arising from two religions in conflict, and that, whereas he had reverted with apparent willingness to Kelolo's native gods, he had not easily cleansed himself of Abner's god, and the incompatible deities warred in his heart. They also knew, as Hawaiians, that if Keoki ever decided to die, he would do so. They had watched their fathers and uncles announce, "I am going to die," and they had died. Therefore, when one young man repeated his question, "Do you think Keoki has decided to die?" the group pondered it seriously, and this was their consensus. "We think he knows that he cannot survive with two gods fighting for his heart." Actually, the question was of no importance, for Lahaina was about to be visited by a pestilence known as the Scourge of the Pacific. On earlier trips to Hawaii, this dreadful plague had wiped out more than half the population, and now it stood poised in the forecastle of a whaler resting in Lahaina Roads, prepared to strike once more with demonic force, killing, laying waste, destroying an already doomed population. It was the worst disease of the Pacific, measles. This time it started innocently by jumping from the diseased whaler and into the mission home, where immunities built up during 100 generations in England and Massachusetts confined the disease to a trivial childhood sickness. Jerusha, inspecting her son Micah's chest one morning, found the customary red rash. "Have you a sore throat?" she asked. And when Micah said yes, she informed Abner, "I'm afraid our son has the measles." Abner groaned and said, "I suppose Lucy and David and Esther are bound to catch it in turn." And he took down his medical books to see what he should do for the worrisome fever. Medication was simple, and the routine not burdensome, so he said, "We'll plan for 3 weeks of keeping the children indoors." But it occurred to him that it might be prudent to see if John Whipple had any medicine for reducing the fever more quickly, and so he stopped casually by J&W's to report, "Worse luck. Micah seems to have the measles, and I suppose..." Whipple dropped his pen and cried, "Did you say measles?" "Well, spots on his chest." "Oh, my God," Whipple mumbled, grabbing his bag and rushing to the mission house. With trembling fingers, he inspected the sick boy, and Jerusha saw that the doctor was perspiring. "Are measles so dangerous?" she asked with apprehension. "Not for him," Whipple replied. He then led the parents into the front room and asked in a whisper, "Have you been in contact with any Hawaiians since Micah became ill?" "No," Abner reflected. "I walked down to your store." "Thank God," Whipple gasped, washing his hands carefully. "Abner, we have only a slight chance of keeping this dreadful disease away from the Hawaiians, but I want your entire family to stay in this house for 3 weeks. See nobody." Jerusha challenged him directly. "Brother John, is it indeed the measles?" "It is," he replied, "and I would to God it were anything else. We had better prepare ourselves, for there may be sad days ahead." Then, awed by the gravity of the threat, he asked impulsively, "Abner, would you please say a prayer for all of us, for Lahaina? Keep the pestilence from this town." And they knelt while Abner prayed. But men from the infected whaler had moved freely through the community, and on the next morning Dr. Whipple happened to look out of his door to see a native man, naked, digging himself a shallow grave beside the ocean, where cool water could seep in and fill the sandy rectangle. Rushing to the reef, Whipple called, "Kekwana, what are you doing?" And the Hawaiian, shivering, fearfully replied, "I am burning to death, and the water will cool me." At this, Dr. Whipple said sternly, "Go back to your home, Kekwana, and wrap yourself in tapa. Sweat this illness out, or you will surely die." But the man argued, "You do not know how terrible the burning fire is." And he sank himself in the salt water, and within the day he died. Now, all along the beach, Hawaiians, spotted with measles, dug themselves holes in the cool, wet sand, and in spite of anything Dr. Whipple could tell them, crawled into the comforting waters and died. The cool irrigation ditches and taro patches were filled with corpses. Through the miserable huts of the town, the pestilence swept like fire, burning its victims with racking fevers that could not be endured. Dr. Whipple organized his wife, the Hales, and the Janders.